the picture that I took of Sean eating with ice cream.
That's good. Okay, good evening.
The deeper meaning is that how hard it is sometimes to understand just because of the translation issues.
Yeah, well, that's going to be the fun part about the unicorn.
The mud mouse.
And Sarah can be our resident, trying to think of, like, mammalologist. Animals.
Well, I know fish is an ichthyology.
Yeah. Maybe invertebratology. Vertebratology. Okay. Any rate, I want to acknowledge Dr. Jeremy Brown, who runs a really good blog called Talmudology. It talks about all kinds of Talmudic topics. So tonight we're going to talk about three animals that occur in the Talmud, one being real, one being semi-real, and one being question mark to hold the suspense till the end. That's the unicorn. So the first one is the fire salamander, and we start with the list in Leviticus of unclean creeping things. Someone's in, Adam, you could be my designated reader, or Sarah, you could be designated reader.
Okay.
So read that, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
The following shall be unclean for you from among the things that swarm on the earth: the mole, the mouse, and the great lizard of its kind, the gecko, the land crocodile, the lizard, the sand lizard, and the chameleon.
Okay, so these are swarming things, as it says, things that creep along the ground, because there's also things that live in the water and there's things that live in the air. And as Lawrence started with pointing out, that, you know, we don't know necessarily what a lot of these things are. So Rashi's comment on this is that this is in the place of Leviticus that talks about unclean things, but not in the category of things that you can't eat because they're unclean. That's a separate part. So these are things that actually make you unclean, ritually unclean, which is called tameh in the Torah, as opposite of tahor, where you get unclean by touching them. And when you are in the unclean state, you can't do various things like make sacrifices or eat sacrifices or even enter the temple. And Ibn Ezra points out that we have no way of knowing what these eight creatures are, or the birds that come before this, except through tradition. You want it's kind of like a proof of Judaism. Okay, so moving on, we're going to get to the salamander. So now we have some text in the Babylonian Talmud from the tractate Chulin. Reader, please.
With regard to the topic of the eight creeping animals mentioned in the Torah, the sages taught in a
baraita. So a baraita is a statement in the Talmud that comes out of nowhere that is authoritative, that is true.
The verse, the great lizard after its kind, includes in the category of creeping animals the arvad, the type of snake, and also the creeping animals called nephilim and salamander.
Yeah, so these are the terms. Sav is the creeping lizard.
Sav.
Kabar bar. Benhan nephilim. So the arvad is thought to be some kind of cross between a snake and a toad, maybe a water snake. The nephilim is a skink, which is a kind of lizard. And the salamander is a salamander. Continue, please.
A proposed salamander, which was thought to generate from fire, the baraita continues. When Rabbi Akiva would reach this verse in Leviticus, he would exclaim, "How great are your works, O Lord!"
Okay, so here we have the key thing. It was thought to be generated from fire, so it was created in a fire. Go on.
Similarly, you have creatures that grow in the fire, and you have creatures that grow in the air. If those in the fire would ascend to the air, they would immediately die. Those in the air would descend to the fire, they would immediately die. Therefore, how great are your works, O Lord?
So what they're talking about here, which may be a deeper topic, which is about boundaries. So things that live in one place would die in another. things that live in the air would die in the fire. Things that live in the fire would die in the air. And so there we have the salamander. So now we're going to zoom in on the salamander. And we have Rashi's comment on it from this piece of Talmud.
And the salamander, the creeping thing that is created from the fire of myrtle trees by magicians, and he who anoints with his blood will be fire
food. Okay, so there's the first, the smoking gun that Rashi says that this salamander is a lizard basically that comes out of fire. And moreover, it's a mystical thing because its blood makes you fireproof. Okay, so salamanders are mentioned in many places in the Torah, and we're going to see how it connects to fire. And the first quote is from the Tanakh, the Book of Kings, and it talks about idol worship and that there was a cult practice where parents sacrificed their children by burning them in fire. Please read.
But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel and made his sons to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen, whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel.
Okay, so that's child sacrifice in the Tanakh, and it's, of course, a bad thing. And now we have another quote. That's just the setup. So now in the tractate Sanhedrin, they're commenting on this verse.
Of the father of Hezekiah,
good,
king of Judea, also tempted to do so to him, i.e. to burn him as an offering to an idol, but his mother rubbed him with the blood of the salamander.
So here we have the magic blood of the salamander protects you from fire. And Rashi comments on this.
The salamander is a small creature that emerges from a furnace which has been burning for 7 consecutive years. Fire cannot burn someone who has smeared himself with the blood of a salamander.
Okay, so that's weird, right? What does this fire burning for 7 years have to do? So, and we'll see here, some of the fun of this kind of stuff is where do they get these ideas from that we don't necessarily know anymore? And in this case, Rashi is looking at Midrash, which comes from the same period as the Mishnah, early Talmud. But Midrash comments on the verses in the Torah. And here we have the verses about the salamander. So you want to read this one out?
Sure. There are creatures that thrive in the air but do not thrive in fire. And conversely, there are creatures that thrive in a fire but do not thrive in the air. If one that lives in the air enters a fire, he cannot survive. And if one that lives in fire ascends into the air, he cannot survive.
Okay, so we already saw that. So here's where it's coming from.
Yet Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were hurled into the fire and went forth unscathed, as it is said. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth.
So this is a famous incident most people know from the Book of Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar is it Nebuchadnezzar or is it Belshazzar? I don't remember. Throws these guys into the fire because they won't worship him, and they're marching around real happy, and they come out, and they're fine. So that's the tome, the text here of things that live in fire that are not harmed by fire. Go on.
The creature that thrives in fire but does not thrive in the air is the salamander. How do we know this? When glass blowers are about to fashion glass objects, they stoke their furnace for 7 days and 7 nights. When the fire becomes extremely hot, a creature similar to a lizard that is called a salamander comes out. If a man should smear his hand or any part of his body with its blood, fire will not affect that place or the animals created in fire.
Okay, so here we see probably where Rashi got the 7 years, except here it's 7 days, which seems more rational. I also want to point out that this is really not well known, but glass blowing was considered a Jewish art in that time period. It was like the Jewish profession, and that would be the garment industry. But in those days, Jews were glass blowers, which is interesting. Okay, so that's where we start to get the salamander thing. And of course, the sages wanted to do something more religious with this idea. So Please.
From this fact, our sages taught that the fire of Gehenna does not affect the scholar, deriving this a fortiori from a salamander. For if the blood of a salamander, which is merely created in fire, can make a man's body immune to fire, how much more so with the scholar who observes the law, which is a fiery law, given by one who is a consuming fire, and of whose teacher is said, the house of Jacob shall be a fire, be immune from the fire of Gehenna. Hence it is said, how great are thy works, O Lord.
So, this is now a homiletical device, right? Torah is fire. Scholars who imbibe the words of Torah become fireproof. And that's where they're coming, and they wind up back with that same verse you keep seeing, how great are your works, O Lord. And below you have a picture of the Near Eastern fire salamander.
It's very cute. What if they have salamanders that look like this?
That, yeah. We saw an exhibit in the Adirondacks on it was very cool. They took kind of like a square meter of land and they lifted it up, and there's like hundreds of salamanders living in there.
Excellent question.
The Vernal Pond.
Yes.
What's the definition of Gehenna again?
Gehenna is hell.
Okay.
Wait, the salamander was really making fireproof?
That's the thought. So, now I'm going to give you some background that's not here. So Leonardo da Vinci says the salamander has no digestive organs and gets no food, but only from fire, in which it constantly renews its scaly skin. So the salamander, thousands of years later, still had that same fire association with it. This is also found in some contemporary places. Who here has read Ray Bradbury's novel Fahrenheit 451? So in Fahrenheit 451, books are banned. The firemen don't put out fires, they create fires, and the names of their fire trucks are salamanders.
I didn't remember that.
And they also had an official symbol, which is a salamander. And that's the little picture on the top of the next page.
Which is true, I never knew this.
Yes. That's what I'm saying, there's like fun things that go with it. And next to the picture of the Salamander Fire Department is the actual logo of the International Association of Heat and Frost Workers, which must be a union. And the picture is a salamander sitting on a pipe, which is insulated from the fire. So that's kind of fun. Now, we get to a Christian scholar in the year 300 who didn't really believe that salamanders were fireproof. Sarah, this is right up your alley. So what did he do? He wrote, where it is commonly said that a salamander extinguisheth the fire, we have found by experience that insofar as from quenching hot cold, it dieth immediately therein. So apparently what he did was he threw salamanders on the fire to see if they would live it. No surprise, they did not.
Always experiment.
Yes.
I don't think that's what they intended. The scholars, like, when they said that they're fireproof, I don't think they literally killed them with the fire.
They should have tried on smearing blood on themselves.
And then, yeah, no, I think they were happier throwing them in the fire. So where does this come from? And there's a long study by a Dr. Warburg, who is, I wrote in my notes, the salamander guy from the Technion, that salamanders only spend about 1% of their adult life in ponds. The rest of the time they live in rotting logs or in under leaves, like I saw in the Adirondacks. This may explain the origin of this legend. When our ancestors would gather logs to light a fire, they might inadvertently sweep up a salamander or two, and when they lit it on fire, the salamanders would scuttle out of the fire as quickly as they could, and ta-da, it looked like they were born from flames. Perhaps this is where this whole legend comes from. So that is the salamander. Animal one. I just thought it was really fun to learn these things.
It is. I'm having fun.
Okay, I'm glad. Okay, now we go into creature number two, the mud mouse. And this comes from the same tractate, Kulin, right before, actually, the salamander story. So we'll shift now back to Sarah. You can read on page 3.
There is a mouse that is part made from flesh and half from dirt. and does not procreate. With regard to a mouse, which is half flesh and half earth, if a man touched the flesh, he becomes unclean. But if he touched the earth, he remains clean.
So, again, this is about swarming creatures that make you impure by touching them. And because this creature is thought to be half flesh and half earth, if you touch the flesh part, you're unclean. But if you touch the dirt part, that does not make you unclean. So, what does Rashi say about this? About it does not procreate.
This means it does not sexually reproduce, but instead it spontaneously appears.
Go on.
There is a species of mouse that does not reproduce sexually, but it spontaneously generates from the earth, just as maggots appear in garbage sites.
Okay, so all this goes under the name of spontaneous generation, which is the arrival of life from non-life. And the ancients absolutely believed that this is what happened. So mice could arrive, live mice could arise out of the dirt. Maggots arise out of garbage. There's even a whole discussion in the Talmud about the rabbis thought that lice also came from dirt. And therefore were not living things. And there's discussion of whether you could squash a lice on Shabbat, because normally you can't wound an animal, and they decided you could because lice are not really alive. So I just want to throw that in. So now we have a story about the rabbis defending this concept of spontaneous generation. So please read that.
A certain heretic said to Rabbi Ami.
Ami.
Okay. He said that the dead will live. Aren't they dust?
Wait, so, hold on. So, certain heretic means probably a Christian denier, and he's fighting with the rabbis over the concept that the dead can revive and become alive again.
He said that the dead will live. Aren't they dust? And does dust come to life? Rabbi Ami said to him, I will tell you a parable. To what is this matter comparable? It is comparable to a flesh and blood king who said this to his servants. Don't construct for me a great palace and a place where there is no water and earth available. They went and constructed it. Sometime later, the palace collapsed. The king said to them, return to your labor, construct the palace in a place where there is earth and water available. They said to him, we are unable to do so. The king became angry at them and said to them, in a place where there is no water and earth available, you constructed a place. Now that there is a palace. Now that there is water and earth available, all the more so you should be able to do so. Similarly, concerning man, whom God created ex nihilo,
literally from nothing.
All the more so will God be able to resurrect him from dust.
Okay, so this is a defense here of life arriving from non-life, and it's a fun parable. There are thousands, literally, of these flesh and blood king stories in the Talmud that prove all kinds of things. All right, so now we cut to the mouse in itself.
If you do not believe that a being can be created from dust, go out to the valley and see a mouse, a creature that today is half flesh and half earth. And tomorrow the being will develop and all of it will become flesh. Thus you say the creation of living creatures is a matter that develops over an extended period. Ascend a mountain and see that today there is only one snow there. Then ascend tomorrow after rain will have fallen and see that it will be entirely filled with snow.
Alright, so these are two proofs that life comes from non-life. And the mouse one is pretty interesting because it seems to happen in stages. Right? The first stage is it's half real, half not, and then it becomes a real mouse. And the snail thing is interesting because you get the point that they couldn't figure out where the snails came from once it became. It's like the worms coming out of the ground after it rains.
Because there are waterlogged under there.
Pardon me?
There's a reason for that.
What?
It's waterlogged.
Well, they didn't know.
Well, that's why the snails come too, presumably. I'm not a snailologist, but.
And snails like reproduce like themselves.
Yeah. So, lest you think this is just a quaint and odd idea, here we have Maimonides coming along 1,000 years later, talking about the mouse, and here's what he says. Please read.
The case of the mouse, which uniquely grows from the earth so that it is half flesh and half dust and mud, is very well known. There is no end to the countless numbers of those who have told me that they have seen it, even though the existence of this creature is astonishing, and there's no known explanation for it.
Okay, so does Maimonides believe in spontaneous generation?
No.
It would seem not.
I can't tell.
But he does seem to be defending it. So he seems skeptical, but he doesn't reject the idea. And this, so it was a widely accepted explanation for centuries before and centuries after Maimonides. So you're going to ask me, how could the rabbis believe in spontaneous generation? And the answer is, everyone in the world believed it until the time of Louis Pasteur, my old friend, which is not that long ago.
He's best friends with Pedro II.
So I have a quote from Aristotle here. So with animals, some spring forth from parent animals according to their kind, whilst others grow spontaneously and not from kindred stock. And of these instances of spontaneous generation, some come from putrefying earth or vegetable matter. So this was an accepted theory throughout the Middle Ages. It was in the writings of the Arab scholars, Sir Francis Bacon. It believed it. William Harvey, who discovered circulation of blood. And why would you not believe in spontaneous generation, right? Until what scientific event happened that would make people change their mind? Anton von Leeuwenhoek?
Oh, the flies.
Microscope.
Oh.
Anton von Leeuwenhoek invited the microscope in 1676. And he saw little tiny micro creatures in lake water. And it took another 200 years till Louis Pasteur did the great experiment. I learned about this in school, but I don't know if you did, about the flask with the neck.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You learned that too.
I learned that in school. I also learned about Anton von Leeuwenhoek.
Yes.
But they didn't believe that all creatures were spontaneously created. I mean, some they believed.
But they had a basis for which to know that there was life that they couldn't see that was really tiny.
Okay, now I remember.
Which would explain
the
things.
The solution inside was like pure, and then like when it had the curved glass, things couldn't get in, so it didn't.
Exactly. So it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the mud mouse. Now we go on to the last item, the Jewish unicorn. Okay, so in the Tractate Zevachim, which means sacrifices, there's a side discussion of something called a re'em, which is an animal of enormous size. And the Talmud wonders, how did it survive the great flood? One possibility is that it fled to Israel, where according to some, the waters of the flood did not reach. But others say the flood even did reach Israel. In that case, how could the re'em survive? It would not have hidden Israel, and it would have been too big to fit inside the ark. So here's the answer from Rabbi Yannai. And Adam, why don't you start reading?
You got it. Rabbi Yannai says, they brought Re'em cubs into the ark, and they survived the flood. But doesn't Rabbi Bar Chana say, I have seen a day-old offspring of the Re'emah, and it was as large as Mount Tabor. And how large is Mount Tabor? It is 40 parasangs, and the length of the cub's neck was 3 parasangs, and the place where its head rests, i.e. its neck, was a parasang and a half.
I think a parasang is about a kilometer. It's like 6/10 of a mile.
When it cast its feces, it dammed up on the Jordan River, so even the cub would have been too large for the ark. Rabbi Yochanan says, they brought only the head of the cub into the ark, while its body remained outside. The Gemara asks, but didn't Rabbi Bar Chana say that the size of the place where its head rests was a parasang and a half? Consequently, even its head alone would not fit into the ark. Rather, they brought the edge of its nose into the ark so that it might breathe.
Okay, so this is fun, right? This is huge animal. It's so big that the only way it could have survived the floods with its nose. So what is a re'em? Well, it turns out the re'em is mentioned 8 times in the Hebrew Bible. So I have a couple of examples that use the word re'em. And let's start reading. The first one's in Deuteronomy.
Like a firstling bull in his majesty, he has horns and the horns of the re'em. With them he gores the peoples, to the ends of the earth, one and all. These are the myriads of Ephraim. Those are the thousands of Manasseh.
Okay, so the context here is in Deuteronomy, they're talking about the offspring of Joseph. And this verse, so it says for M is identified, I'm a little confused about my own thing here, that the translation, Aramaic translation of the Bible by Onkelos says that this is one of the species singled out in the Torah as being kosher, the Re'em, so whatever it is. Okay, now we have another one, another quote from Numbers.
These are the animals that you may eat. The deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, the Dishon, the antelope, the mountain sheep.
And once again, the Lawrence thing, we don't, what does Dishon mean? So the same Onkelos translates that word as Re'em. So it fits into these kind of ungulates, how's that for a technical word? Horse-like animals that are of a certain size. Now finally we get to a quote from the book of Job. And here, I did not translate the word Re'em, but it's the word in the text, and then I'll tell you what they translated it as.
Would the Re'em agree to serve you? Would he spend the night at your crib? Can you hold the Re'em by ropes to the furrow? Would he plow up the valleys behind you?
I wonder if Ludacris would say nights in your crib. Now, that's kind of the actual quote from into English, and in most places, Re'em here is translated as wild ox, which if you go back to the previous verse, kind of fits. And now, here we have the fun part. So on the top of the next page, the King James translation of the Bible, which was produced by 50 academics based on Hebrew and Greek texts, translated it as,
will the unicorn be willing to serve thee, or abide by thy crib? Canst thou bind the unicorn with his band in the furrow, or will he have the valleys after thee?
Okay, so where did they get unicorn from is now the question.
Is it because is there an issue with the Greek? I mean, isn't that part of the problem with King James, as you said? A lot of the King James is a translation of the Greek translation of Hebrew, which is even one step removed.
Bingo. So, you're right. So it comes from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Torah in the 3rd century BCE. Does everyone know the story of the translation of the Septuagint?
No.
Okay, so it's in the Babylonian Talmud that King Ptolemy of Egypt gathered 72 elders, and he placed each one in a room by himself on an island, and he gave them the job of translating the Torah. He didn't tell them what the other ones were doing. And he said, write for me the Torah of Moshe, your teacher. God put it in the heart of each one, and they translated it. And lo and behold, when they finished this task, which I think took 70 days, all the translations from Hebrew to Greek were identical. So in the Septuagint, they translated the word Re'em as into the Greek monokeros. Mono, one. Keros means horn, related to the Hebrew word keren for horn, probably related to the English word cornucopia, which is a horn, the horn of plenty. So you can make the comment that they're really translating from Hebrew into one horn animal for Re'em. So it's really a Jewish translation. So this translation made its way into later rabbinic commentary. And we have a commentator from 1160 who said in his Dictionary of the Hebrew Language that the Re'em has only one horn. And then we come to one Abraham Yagel, who lived in 1600, who was an Italian rabbi, and he came up with this comment.
And in our days, a Re'em was brought to Portugal from India, having been ambushed and trapped. Afterwards, sea travelers reported how it looked. It is larger than an elephant, and its scales cover all its skin. It has a thick horn on its nose, which it uses in fights with the elephant and other creatures.
What is this animal? What's a big animal? Say it.
Oh, okay, a rhino.
Describing a rhinoceros.
As I said, it didn't sound like a unicorn.
And historically, we know the first rhinoceros was brought to Europe since Roman times. Was around this time it came from India, and it caused a huge sensation in Italy. So that's what the thinking was, the unicorn was a rhino. However, there have been no rhinoceroses in Israel for 35,000 years. And the verse we just read in Deuteronomy talks about horns in plural. So even if it were outlandishly a rhinoceros, why would it have two horns? Unicorn has one horn. So, what is this animal, the Re'em, right? We still don't know. So there's two candidates for it. One of them is called an auroch, which is an animal that does not exist. It became extinct in 1600s. And there's a picture here. So it was a big animal. It weighed 1,500 pounds. Not as big as Mount Tabor. And it has two horns, but from the side, it could look like one horn. And interestingly enough, this is what scholars think is the animal that you see all the time in the cave paintings at Lascaux. It's an auroch. So that's one possibility. Well, no, it's a bull. It's an ox of some kind.
The ones that your brothers drew?
Yeah. My dad. The other possibility is it's an Arabian oryx, which you see the second picture below. There is a white oryx, and it used to be found in the Arabian desert. It is a white and beautiful animal, and it has now been reintroduced, and it even is in Israel, and they now call it a biblical oryx.
I've seen one.
And that might well be, having been seen from the side, the source of a unicorn. The oryx once was the lord of the Middle East. Its domain embraced most of the land of Israel. It also lives in the Sinai deserts and the Syrian deserts, and even in the Arabian Peninsula, the great Nafud, and the forbidding Rub al Khali. It was a prince of the land from the Mediterranean to the Arabian Sea. So is there such a thing as a Jewish unicorn? It's up to you. The end.